Sports Show. I'm here today with my guest comedian, Josh Adam Myers. Josh?
Yes. I am so underdressed for that. We were just talking about that before. She's like, let's just wait until we get started. But Chelsea, you are like so done up. You look gorgeous. But for you, it's very effortless. But and for me, I need work if I really want to look good. But like I've just made a pact to myself that until I can get back on stage, I'm not putting jeans on. Do you know what I mean?
This took 10 minutes. I've been sitting outside. I'm wearing sweatpants on the bottom. Let's keep it real.
Okay, yeah, but this.
This is, lipstick is, I didn't shower today, cover up.
You're very fortunate where, because you have such a model face and body that it's just very, just a, you just need slight touch-ups that accentuate what you have compared to like other people that need to like lather shit on. So that's what I'm saying. Just, you probably just were like, I'm going to put some shit on my lips. And by me saying that, I'm like, oh shit, she's done up because she hardly ever wears makeup. So if you put some on your lips, it pops.
I wear so much makeup. I always wear a lot of makeup. I'm always wearing a lot of eyeliner. Like, do you recognize that? Or I don't think guys notice stuff. Do you recognize that? Shows eyeliner.
I am like fascinated by you. I always have been fascinated by you, especially from getting to know you over the years, because I would have never thought you had such complex layers the deeper and deeper you go. And I'm not talking about addiction and shit like that. I'm talking about like you would have been perfectly cast as a server at Jack Rabbit Slim in Pulp Fiction. Like, you have that, like, it wasn't just like a little like a shimmy, like you were born in a different, you should have been born, like you should have been in the 70s. You and your mom probably should have switched. And because I just think that like I'm, you know, it's funny, as I'm getting ready to record a podcast about the album Portishead Dummy. And that's exactly what I was thinking, because as I put it on, we were getting ready to do this. So today, as I was working out, I'm listening to the record and I'm like, I bet Chelsea really likes this record.
I've been listening to it a lot during quarantine. It's like great for like a Sunday daytime, just like
depression. Nice depression.
No, for me, it's just like moving around the apartment, like taking care of business. Like, I don't know. It's such a great like mood.
What I am fascinated about trip hop, which I always have since I first heard it, I was like, I remember hearing Portishead first, then Massive Attack, and then Tricky, and so on and so forth. I made this decision right away. Let me turn the volume up. There it is. Can you hear me better?
That sounds 100% better.
Yeah.
Part of me was like, that's also his voice, though.
No, it's, I'm not good at this. There you go. But there's something so dark and sexy about that music. Like, I have this belief that, like, you know, people in England weren't having good sex until Portishead came out. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's like, I remember when I finally started having sex regularly in my like 20s, where it was like, all right, now I'm like, I got a place and I'm bringing girls over. I mean, it was like right before we started fucking, I was like, hold on, let me put Portishead on. And do you guys put music on? Do you and Steven put music on to set the mood?
I'm the only one who will ever like put music on, but music is not like a normal part of like our sex life. But like every once in a while, like if I'm like, I'll do this thing every once in a while, I haven't done it in a long time, where, you know, I'll put on like alternative, like K-rock, like 90s, like K-rock kind of music. Do you know what I mean when I say that?
Yeah, it's just like, gah, 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 father of mine.
No,
where
no,
do you
no, no, no,
and you're just like, ha, ha,
no,
you just,
no,
you're taking
No, I'll put on like Soundgarden or Alice in Chains. That's what I'm talking about. Do you not, is that not 90s K-rock to you?
No, it's great. It's great.
Wait, but is that not?
I mean, it's.
How did we get to Eve 6?
That wasn't Eve 6. That was Everclear.
Oh, see, like both of those are the same.
No. Well, all right, you're 100% right. They're similar in the sense that both bands had three members and both lead singers had very, very short hair. But Eve Six only has one song that I remember, and that was the one that you might have gotten confused with. Eve Six's hit was, I'ma swallow my pride, I'ma take it inside, got but I'ma no faith in body, wanna tell you bender, taught in a blender.
Tender heart and
blender. In a blender, yeah.
But that's not like cool K-rock. Wasn't that like a little, wasn't that like early 2000s?
Well, music has done this thing where it becomes cool and like the genre becomes cool and then it gets too big and then it crumbles back to starting over. So for an example, hair metal got so big that it crumbled to become grunge, which is just stripped down rock and roll. And then grunge started getting like super big. And then when that got so huge, it became like new metal and shit like that. And that's like the height of it needing to come back down. And then it became the Strokes. So Eve Six and Everclear are kind of right at that height, right before, I think, the Strokes. I might be a little confused. The statement's true.
It's like different, but like Eve Six and Everclear, I don't know where they're from, but those are like Southern California to me. Like Southern California rock bands, where the Strokes is like cool New York City.
Yeah,
like,
but
they're kind of like, I wouldn't even like look at them.
But what I'm saying is the Strokes is the reaction from everybody else. So grunge took off, then it suddenly became new metal, and you have Limp Bizkit and Korn and all of these bands, and then it goes, then they smash cut all the way back to now, where it's just the most minimalistic rock and roll, which is the Strokes. And then the Strokes slowly builds, and that's where you get, like, I think Everclear is still in the grunge, and I think Eve Six is kind of still right as the grunge is starting to, like, from my, listen, it all blends together, but for some reason I'm thinking Eve Six is like 1998, 1999, maybe.
It feels very like, and you're the music expert, not me, but like Eve Six and Everclear is in the same category as like Blink-182 for me.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd call it all pop punk, but like it's just like annoying.
Oh no, I completely agree with you.
It's like like none of those people have done here. Like they're straight edge musicians.
It's corporate. It's kind of like REO Speedwagon and Styx and Kansas and all of those bands that were like rock and roll, but not really rock and roll. Do you know what I mean? It was like a formula. Mm-hmm. It was just like, all right, so we'll take some of the elements of like Led Zeppelin. We'll take some of the elements of Yes or whatever it is, these out there bands, and then we'll make it into a more like Foreigner, like Journey. I hate to call Journey corporate rock, but Journey is corporate rock. But the thing is, they're great.
Corporate rock. Corporate rock
is it's formulaic. It's so whoever's buying, the A&R guy, is like, all right, well, this is cool and this is making money. All right, so I'll give you an example. So Pearl Jam is an original idea, an original sound, and an original band. The corporate version of that is Creed.
Ugh.
And no, don't put down Creed. Don't put down Creed, man. And
because status about Creed or Nickelback, I will explain to you why Creed or Nickelback is good. Was that you?
So, well, yeah, I did something on Twitter where I said, name whatever band you hate, and I'll tell you why they're good. And I'll give you like an example of why I think they're actually a good band. So it was just a way to get like some good interaction. But then at the same time, I was like, first of all, you can't shit on Nickelback. Nickelback was huge. They wrote incredible pop songs. And I mean, I've talked to, you know, we both have a friend that's a mutual songwriter, and we got into a discussion about that. And she was like, you can shit on Nickelback all you want, but dude, they not only made a shitload of money, but they had, their songs are perfect pop songs. And the same thing with Creed. Creed was just a poppier version of Pearl Jam.
There was a good strip club Nickelback song. Is that, what's the cowboy?
Like the pants beneath your face. No, no.
Something, it was like more of a cowboyish song. You
know? Show me that photograph.
No, like, no. No. Like, is there something like I want to be a, no, no. Fuck, what is that song?
It's the one. I already sang it. It was the first one I sang.
Do it again.
It was like, I like your pants around your feet. Dan, dan, ch, ga, gang, gang, ch, ga, ga. I like the something in your feet. Dan. Then he goes like, I like your see, bon, double, see, but I'm fucking it up. But your listeners right now are 100% agreeing with me. They're like, yeah.
No. There's something else. I'll have to text it to you and think of it. But like when it would come on, like at strip clubs, I would secretly like it. I don't want to talk about how you were a strip club teacher.
No, it's fine. I never got to play Creed or Nickelback at the strip clubs I DJed at
where was that, by the way? And we don't have to get
No, we can get it. It's fine. Because it's just a natural, you know, you mentioned strip clubs and I worked when I was basically on the verge of being completely flat broke in my first year of stand up, and I couldn't find a job. And this bouncer was like, dude, you DJ, right? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, dude, you should be a strip club DJ. And I was like, all right. And he goes, trust me, if you go out tomorrow, you'll get hired. And just go to like 5 strip clubs and get hired at 2 of them. And he was right. And then I got hired into Spearmint Rhino. And then I worked at one of their shit clubs called Rouge, which was basically just a whorehouse, but it was like super chill. You have to realize in Los Angeles, all strip clubs are in the same area that cement and tile is made. Like if there's a train track around and cement being brewed, they say, you know what would be perfect for this area? A strip club.
Really?
Like right next to a recycling plant. That's the perfect place for a strip club.
I've noticed there's a lot downtown, right?
Yeah, because that's where they make cement. And that's where like the Purdue chicken factory is. And like, so I worked at one. I know it's disgusting. I worked at 2 for Spearmint Rhino. Those are the ones that took the most of my time. One for 3 years and the other one for 3 years. One, the first one was called Rouge. And Rouge
Wait.
What?
The song is the one that's like, Donna off my back. I'm on a, fuck!
You had it. It's gone already. What if we just waste a whole episode of us just no, just give me a second. Just give me a second. I've got it. I've got your ski above my ski.
I have a thing where I sing when I go to people. You know that song that's like, da-na-na-na-na? And they're like, no, I don't know what da-na-na. I'm the worst at recounting what songs are.
Usually, I can actually, like, I know the melodies, so I can hit the melodies to make you know it enough. I'm going to tell you right now, Chels, your fans are listening to this episode right now, screaming out the name of the Nickelback song, like, what the fuck is your problem, Chelsea and Josh? How the fuck don't you know it?
I know it.
I think it's called like here.
Oh, it's Aw Fuck.
It's called Aw Fuck. It's kind of different for Nickelback. I like you, dee ba dee ba doo.
Ugh, forget it. Maybe it's called. No. Okay, so what about Rouge?
So Rouge was in Van Nuys, and it was in the middle of nowhere, and it was a shithole, but it was like a straight up like it was a whorehouse. I mean, I worked day shift, and it was just, you know, we had Amara who had these big fake boobs, and she would get like, you know, 5 to 10 half hours a shift and tip me like $40 to $50, and we had this other girl, Isis. She would do 5 to 10 half hours a shift and she would tip me $40 or $50 and they would go back for the half hour and literally come out after one song. Like the half hour is supposed to be 10 songs, but they would go in for one and come out after one. Like that was it. And so I worked there and that one was kind of fun. There wasn't really much money. But then in 2013, I found out they were opening up a club in downtown LA called Dames and Games.
Oh yeah, I've heard that. I love that name.
And it was like a topless sports bar. And I started working day shift and I was making like really good money. And I'm, you know, I'm as a comic, I'm just, I talk a lot of shit. So everybody liked me. All the girls loved me. Like I would cuss at the guy. I would like make fun of people that weren't spending money. And then they were like, you should work night shifts. And I was like, I don't really want to work night shifts. I do stand-up comedy. And they're like, you can make what you make in 2 weeks working night. And I was like, all right, well, I'll try it. And the first night I worked, I was like a Wednesday night. I made like $500. And I was like, okay. I was like, I'll work two nights a week.
Yeah.
And then I worked there. And to be honest with you, Chelsea, like the, when I took over those night shifts, so this is like not February, I'd say like April of 2013. And I met Dames and Games. I started working nights, dude. It was an ATM. I was making $800 to $1,000 a night.
Wow.
And it was the most fun I've ever had at a job because the guy that was the GM wasn't a strip club guy. He was like a bar dude. He used to run nightclubs and it was just, he made it a party. He hired really fun, cool people and we just made money and had a great time. And then he left and then the club became a strip club. And then it just completely, like it was just, I hated going to work. Hated it. And every shift.
You're originally from Baltimore?
No, I'm from the Washington, D.C. area.
Oh.
I'm from about 20 minutes north of Washington, D.C. in a town called Germantown. And then I said Baltimore for years because I lived in Baltimore for about 8 years before I moved to LA. But I just thought it as when I was a newer comic, I thought it made me seem cooler.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, because it's close. It's only 30 minutes away from Germantown. So I could say Baltimore, I could say DC, but you know, in the actuality, I'm from a small suburb. Like that's now grown into like one of the fastest growing cities in the country.
Were you in a band in high school or like what was like your vibe growing up?
Well, my vibe, that's an interesting question. I mean, I'll give you my vibe. I was always like this little rocker kid, man, because music just affects me differently than I think most people. Like, I love it. It's like, it touches my soul. So I remember being like 6 years old when I got like my first tape, which was like Beastie Boys, License to Ill. And then I can remember the moment I heard Guns N' Roses. And so I was this little like heavy metal kid until grunge. And then I became, well, I was heavy metal for a while. Then I became a wigger. And I was like hanging out with all the black kids like Tyron Trammell and Junie Hopkins. And I had like the lines here.
I was
listening to like Public Enemy. And that didn't feel right. And people made fun of me because I was always a little guy and trying to play basketball. And then I heard grunge and that was it. And then I just went right back to like my roots, which was, you know, which I think it's funny, like in middle school is such a divided place because people are figuring out who they are. They're all going through puberty. Their bodies are changing. So when you do something that's against the norm or that's different from something that you do and you guys seem alike, people make fun of that. So, you know, we're all trying to figure ourselves out. But in my middle school, it was so divided between if you either liked rock music or you liked hip hop, you couldn't like both. And so I had to choose a size. And so I chose the black people. I was like, well, I like rap. And then I got to high school and I was like, oh, you can like everything. Mm-hmm. And then I found like my clique. I found.
You realized it wasn't like jail that you can be a part of. You didn't have to choose.
You don't. Well, yeah. I mean, it's kind of, dude, middle school, at least mine was because we were a very, you know, Montgomery County, Maryland is one of the richest counties in the country because we have all of the senators and congressmen live in Potomac and live in Bethesda and Silver Spring. And you have just multi millionaires. And then you have like the rest of the county, which is like just middle class and some parts are lower middle class, like rural. So it was, so Seneca Valley, which is Germantown, was a high school in Germantown, was very divided, especially Martin Luther King, which was my middle school, which we were talking about. That was really divided because you're thinking this is like early 90s, you know, you've got like, you know, Two Live Crew, and then you've got like Motley Crue. So you've got like hip hop at its most extreme and rock and roll at like its most extreme. And it just, it was almost like there was this weird race battle in my school, at least at Martin Luther King. And then when I got to high school, it maybe it's just the tension eased because, you know, our balls had dropped and we could start like fingering and touching titties. Do you know what I mean? So in high school, it was kind of like the, when I really started becoming not just who I was, you know, as a human, but I also was able to use my ADHD in my advantage to be this very, very popular, like comic of the school. Like I had, like you asked what my vibe is, I was just this wild man. Cause I was like, I don't think I ever should have been on Adderall, but they had me on Adderall when I was like this super young kid. Oh, so wow. Adderall is just like coke to me. So it just wired me.
Early days Adderall too, when they probably didn't really, I'm sure they were just like prescribing that, not really realizing.
Dude, I remember having to go to lunch. So I would take Ritalin in the morning before kindergarten, and then I'd have to go to lunch, and I would take another pill of Ritalin at lunch.
That's insane.
And I would do that in high school too, but with Adderall.
Wow.
Yeah, dude. So I was like,
that's a very young age. Do you think a kid today would be put on Adderall or Ritalin? Did they still make Ritalin?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I know they make Adderall because, yeah. You know, you probably know a shitload of people that say they're sober and are on Adderall. Like, yeah, dude, it's like, it's, if a doctor gives it to us and it's not an opiate, we're like, no, it's fine. You know, opiate is the only pill a doctor can give us where we're like, no, that's the drug.
I don't,
you know, unless we have the excuse, we're just like, well, I have a bad knee or I have a bad back.
Yeah. Huh? Like a kindergartner, why is that word so hard to say? A kindergartner today would be on Ritalin or Adderall. It seems like something that comes later when you study, but I guess it's like calming down.
I was such a wild kid. Like Chelsea, you got to realize you met me at like, you're getting me at like a 4 or 5. And I used to get in so much trouble because I would never think about the words that came out of my mouth. I would just say it. And I would just, if I wanted to stand up in class and just start talking while the teacher would, I would do that. I remember one time one of my favorite things was like, I just like, and the Ms. Schmetz was doing this math problem. And I just stood up in class in high school and I just walked up to the board and I just grabbed the marker. And on the board, I wrote testicles. No, I wrote scrotum. And it was just like, it was just out of nowhere. So it's like, that's the kind of person I was. I was so like comfortable with making jokes and being this wild character. And then once I became like, I got to high school, it was just off to the races. And then I had this short moment. This is going to take you back. This might even be before you really remember shit, but do you remember the Million Man March?
No.
So the Million Man March was this, it was led by Louis Farrakhan, and it was supposed to be where they get Louis Farrakhan, he's a head of the Nation of Islam, which is like this sect of Muslims, but it's like they're black and they're American. And it's like what Malcolm X was. And Farrakhan's the leader. And he was trying to do this huge thing in Washington, D.C. on the mall where he had a million black men would show up. And he basically talk about how to be proud fathers and you know, just like, do you remember they were like the Promise Keepers. Do you remember the Promise Keepers?
No.
You remember them? Okay. That was basically the white version of that. But that was like super lame. But Million Man March was this huge thing. And in Washington, D.C., around where we lived, everybody was talking about it. And during that time, I did the morning announcements, the televised morning announcements class that you would take in the morning. And every morning, like they would, you know, you'd have your position. You could be the cameraman, you could be doing the editor, whatever it was, and it would go out to the school, right? So this black chick that was like in a grade below me had her own show once a week, every Friday, called Music Madness. And it was like just her talking about the popular music, right? And I was never on camera that often yet. But then on one of the episodes, this chick says something about, she's like, and blah, 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 blah. And that's the new song from them. On another note, I want to give big ups to all my brothers that are going to the Million Man March. And she's like, I'm proud of y'all, or whatever she says. Well, the principal, who was black, was like, yo, you can't do that ever again. You know what I mean? Like, we're not trying to divide us between white and black and this, that, whatever he said. And they took her off that show. So they were like, does anybody else want to host Music Minute? And I was like, yeah, I'll do it. Right. And I'm just like this 10th grader, right? Dude, like, they just let me, they just put the camera on me and just let me go for like 10 minutes. And I fucking crushed it, to the point where I would walk through the hallways and seniors are like, yo, that's that dude from Music Minute. Yo, you funny as shit. Like, teachers would come up to me, the principal. I was the most popular kid. And then it got canceled after that year. But so that just, that you want to talk about vibe, that's the vibe, has always been that wild, like, funny man when I was younger. And then I guess now it's just, you know, I hope people think I'm funny. But I guess it's just, I hate to say it, but it's like, I'm the rock star comic, which I think is the gayest term ever. I hate that.
But it's good to have, like, you know,
a brand.
That is a brand.
Yeah. Oh, well, no, well,
others like you, you're the one that comes to mind.
Yeah. I think that in comedy, it works in my favor in the sense that if an executive is going to say, well, we need a comedian, we need somebody that knows music and is funny, and then I'm on that short list.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And that's great. Like, that was some of the best advice that Sarah Tiana ever gave me. She's like, whatever you are, just lean into that, because there's an audience out there for you. So if in Sarah's case, she's like, I'm a Southern girl that loves sports. She's like, I just lean into that.
Yeah.
And she's right. And when she said that to me, that was right around or right as I was creating the goddamn Comedy Jam. And I was just like, cool, that's what I want to do. I mean, that's the kind of person I am.
Yeah.
I want to turn my air conditioner on. It's hot in here.
What was the first concert you went to?
Well, that's a loaded question. So if it's first concert ever, it would have been seeing like Peter, Paul, and Mary with my parents at Wolf Trap.
Okay.
But the first solo concert I ever went to with a buddy was Bruce Springsteen, during the Lucky Town Human Touch. I think that was the other album during that tour. And then the first, like, but we still got driven there by my friend's dad. And then the first actual concert I went to by myself was, Orange 9mm and Korn.
Korn. I don't know who Orange 9mm is.
They were like, they're like a, I guess, a hardcore punkish band. Mm-hmm. Like, on more in the vein of like Fugazi than like not like, this is like, they like Korn opened for Orange 9mm. This is how early in Korn's career that was.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was great, man, because I remember that was when I was, you know, I think I was a junior in high school, and I was hanging out with Courtney Kelly and Paul Bettinger, and they were just like the cool, like, they were like if Beck's Music came to life and were humans, that's who the friends were. And it was just, we'd go to like Tasty Diner and drink coffee and smoke cigarettes all night. And
sounds like a 90s like indie movie.
It is. It's singles.
Yeah.
I lived, I wasn't old enough to really live singles, but I was like, right there, dude, you know, right there.
Who have you seen perform the most? Like, what?
Beck. I've seen Beck probably like 18 times.
Wow. I always think about when Beck had a bleeding lip on the MTV Movie Awards. Do you remember that? He performed at the MTV.
I don't remember that.
He performed at the MTV Movie Awards, and I remember watching it, and his lip was, like, bleeding. And it's, like, something I just always remembered. Because they would, like, you know, gave, like, close-ups, and you could see his lip was bleeding for some reason.
Like, he bit it, or he just had dry, crusty lips?
Probably, like, he bit it. Maybe he was nervous or something.
Or he was just feeling that guitar solo, and he was just like...
Wow, 18 is a lot.
Huh?
18 is a lot.
Well, You know, I think like as far as music goes, like I become very obsessive when something gets in here. So like, for example, right now, I'm obsessed with this song. You know Massive Attack, right?
Yeah.
They have a song called Teardrop.
Yeah.
Which I love and everybody knows. Well, there's an acoustic version of it by this guy named Jose Gonzalez that they played in the championship winning game scene in episode 8 of the Last Dance, which is a Michael Jordan documentary that's on right now. And it's like, I love it so much. And they played that song and it was just like perfect image to music or music to image. And it just like made me cry. And so I've probably listened to that song 50 times over the last 3 days.
I do
like
that
over too. And over. Yeah.
I do that. I get like so obsessed with like a certain song and I can't stop playing it. Like,
and so, and yeah. And well, because we're also addicts. So we're just like, I want that feeling the way that I heard it the first time. And it's like, we're trying to just replay it. And if it touched us, we're trying to feel the feelings.
And it feels that good for like 4 days. And it's like, I'm sick of this.
I mean, I wear a lot of shit out. So yeah, I'm not there yet with it. But I think that was the same thing with Beck. Beck was just the guy that I never was into really mellow gold. I love Loser, but when Odelay came out in 1998, when I got into it, 97, 98 is when I got into it. I was like, this is, because it was like, dude, Beck was like, he's like Neil Young and Bob Dylan and the Beastie Boys all put into one.
Huh.
Like he's this incredible songwriter. Excuse me. And up until not his last album, but the album before that, Colors, he had never made a bad song. And then he made Colors. And at that point, I remember when Colors came out, we saw the band, me and my buddy Matt, we used to go to a lot of shows together to see Beck. And we went to two of the Color shows and we were like, dude, he's been playing the same lineup for like of songs for like the last 2-3 years. I was like, I think I'm done. And then we both were like, yeah, I don't think I want to go see Beck anymore. Like, he opens with Devil's Haircut, goes into fucking Black Tambourine, goes into this. It's just right down the list. And it's, you know what it is? It was, remember how we were just talking about how, like, you hear a song and you love it and it touches you and so you want to try to get that feeling again, much like when we get high. I went to one Beck show at probably like the fifth Beck show I ever saw, which was out in Santa Cruz, at this theater called the Rio Theater that seats about 600. And it was just Beck, his pianist and his bass player with a drum machine. And it was the most like stripped down, amazing show I'd ever been to the point where it was so laid back that halfway through the show, he goes, anything you guys want me to play? And people are like shouting out the most random songs and he would play them. And it was just the most incredible show. And so for that was 2013. For the next 5 years, me and my buddy were chasing that dragon. Do you know what I mean? Like trying to get that. Oh, maybe this will be the show that he switches up the set list or he plays this, and he never did. And so that was my decision. I was like, I'm not going back. Not for a few years. Not until he gets older.
That does so much sound like drug behavior.
Yeah, dude. I was like, I need a new dealer. I was like, I don't fuck with him anymore.
That's funny. You know what I really loved is when the night that you, me, and Nicole, when we ran into you at Carney's, and you were talking to us about your sort of like spirituality quest and how things have changed for you over the past couple of years.
Yeah.
So can you remind me again, like what kind of happened and like the journey that you took?
Okay.
Because you went into like kind of like a searching.
So yes, and you and me, we're all continuously still searching for like my mantra throughout this quarantine is not, I got to get work done. It's, I got to be happy. If I don't work today, I can give a shit. As long as I'm happy throughout the day, that's all I give a shit about. If two things come out of this, if one thing comes out of it, and the only thing that comes out of this quarantine is being happy, I'm happy with that. So
I've been really happy lately.
Well, we both have a lot, man. You know, one of the things that's good that I am very, very grateful for, and I constantly put on my gratitude list, is that we're already established to a point that when this starts back up, we just fit back into the ecosystem. We don't have to like start over. Mm-hmm. That just makes me like, knowing that this came at a time in my life where I'm like, I'm already like, you know, doing this and doing that. It's just, I'm super, super grateful to be in this situation. But all of that thinking is just like this thing that I've only been dealing with for the last 2 years. So when we were talking about me growing up and me being this hyperactive kid, I never thought about how people perceived me. I didn't care if they liked me or they didn't. I just lived and I was me.
Yeah. It's like getting back to that high school, I don't give a fuck like about what you think kind of vibe.
Say it again because you broke up.
It's like, you know, in high school when you can think back and be like, I was so cool in high school. Like, I didn't give a fuck. Like, I was just me. Like, now I've become this person who like is concerned about like, you know, other people's perception. Like, how do I get back to that cool version of myself? That high school version. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Well, in a sense, yes, because high school and my 20s, I could have given a fuck. Even when I started stand up, I remember Angelo commented to me one night because I walked right up to Kyle Kinane and I started talking to him, and Angela was like, I can't believe you just went up to Kyle Kinane. And I was like, I don't care, he's a dude. And he was like, he's just, you have no fear. And I used to have no fear. Mm-hmm. And then I got into that car accident in 2012 where my best friend Angelo dies in a drunk driver runs a red light, hits my car, Angelo dies, I almost die. And then I created this world inside my mind of how people perceived me, which was because Angelo was this, he was a far better comedian than I could ever be, even at like 20, 30 years of stand-up. It doesn't make a difference. Angelo would still be better at me year one. And people loved him and everybody worshiped Angelo's jokes and loved him as a human being. And I created this lie that everybody wished that Ange would have lived and that I would have been the one that died. It was survivor's guilt. It's a normal, it's a normal situation. People have that and coming back from.
I'm sorry you went through that mentally. That's really
no, and I, and I, and I, yeah, it's, listen, I
hearing that because I didn't know that you felt that way.
Well, because there was, all right, so it started because like everybody would come to the hospital and people were just like there. And I mean, the people at Cedars-Sinai, I remember they said they were like, are you a huge celebrity? And I'm like, no, why? They're like, you've had more visitors in the 2 weeks that you were here than anybody we've ever seen. Like I had hundreds a day. It was just like at least 50 people a day were coming in. And I mean, they'd spend 5 minutes, they'd do like a rotation. 'Cause it was a huge loss to the comedy community to lose Ange. Me and Ange were two like younger up and coming guys and everybody liked us and we hung out at the store. So we were seen. And so I get out of the hospital and then people just saw me acting normal because I was so high on oxys and Dilaudid because I didn't want to feel, and the doctors were still giving it to me, that everybody, I guess, looked at me and was like, oh, well, I guess Josh is fine. And so they just kind of went back to their life. The calls stopped, you know, because for the first like month, everybody was like, you want to hang out? You want to do this? And then it just stopped.
Yeah.
Then it also stopped around the time that I got a new car. So everybody donated me all this money. I mean, they did benefit after benefit, all this shit. And I got paid for my Jeep. I got $5,000. And my mom loaned me a few thousand, and I went and got this 2007 Cadillac CTS. And I posted this picture of it on Facebook, and not thinking it was going to, I thought people would be like, yo, that's awesome, you got a new car back. But a couple comics that were also friends with Ange that were dealing with the pain in their way got really mad at me. And they were like, how could you spend the money on a car? People are giving you all this money. And I'm like, I'm not. I was like, I got a loan and my mom, you know, and I got paid for my car. So I don't understand the problem. And they're like, And then it just, they were, I do not blame them at all, because I've talked to them and I'm cool with everybody now. But it was just, like I said, they were dealing with Ange. They thought one thing and they were wrong. If they wanted to know really what I spent all the money on, I spent it on drugs because I was an addict. I was a full-blown junkie. But because of that whole car incident, Chelsea, like, it just created this war inside my head, which then was the thing that I told you that they wished Ange lived and I died. And I just thought everybody hated me. And it took years. So you have addiction for 7 months from January to May, 5 months really. And then I got sober. Then everything's going good in my career. And then my career starts taking off with the goddamn comedy jam. And then all those feelings came right back, which was that I don't deserve this. I wasn't able to enjoy any of the success, like any of it. Even after I got sober for the second time, for the main time that I got sober, which actually, hold on, 4 more days, it'll be 4 years off of opiates.
Wait, when?
On May 17th.
I have 4 years on Friday.
I know, because you relapsed. Remember, I remember that. When I got sober, I saw you and you're like, yeah, I relapsed. I went to a hotel room and was blowing lines and drinking or whatever you said.
I was at some person's apartment.
Even better. You gotta have company when you do when you fall off the wagon.
And I went to rehab for like 3 days, and I was texting Marilyn Manson asking him to pick me up so I can say you picked me up from rehab.
What did he say?
He was like, "No."
Just the fact that you can text him is so cool.
We haven't talked in a while, but we hung out a bunch, and he was one of my like top favorite. I've seen him in concert the most out of anyone, and he's such a cool guy. And I just, yeah, he's really cool. He's fun.
I'm friends with, I don't know, do you know a guy, I don't know his name's Mark, but everybody calls him Prison Mark. He works on his tour. No. Yeah, he's a homie.
One behind the scenes of his stuff.
I've only seen Marilyn once, which was at Ozfest, 2000 and maybe 2000. Fuck.
He's an incredible performer.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. It's me and Big J Okerson talk about that all the time. Like, cause he loves the bands that I kind of like have these. I like Marilyn Manson, but I love everything about him in the sense of what he's done and his image and what he created. And the same thing with like Korn, and their fans are like nuts for him. They might not be my favorite music, but at the same time, it's just like, I just dig it. But that's awesome, by the way, that you fucking did. I wish you would have picked you up from rehab, because that would have been fucking.
But I do want to get back to what we were talking about. I don't want
to. No, you're good. So cut to, I get sober May 17th, 2016. And it also coincided right a month before we're shooting the goddamn Comedy Jam Hour special for Comedy Central, and then the series and all of this stuff. And that we shoot the series, and as soon as the series wrapped, I was so depressed. I mean, on a level of, I didn't leave my house. We shot it in January. I didn't leave my house till April, I think.
Why do you think you got so depressed? And I can understand, like, you know, when you go to like a really like awesome like party or like a wedding, or like you spend like so much time with people, or like something like really, really, really fun happens, and then like the next few days after that, you like sink into a depression. Was it like one of those kind of things?
Yes and no, because 100% it was the high of recording and then the letdown of it being done. But it had a lot to do with the way I was I don't want to say treated, but the way that I think I was viewed through certain people that were in the higher up people, not just at Comedy Central. But the director, they had a vision of the show that was different than my original vision of it. And they just made their changes. And I was fine with that. And I can look back at everything that happened with the goddamn Comedy Jam and be like, oh, I'm super proud of it. I'm super grateful. It got me my dog. It got me you know, money and security. And to be honest, that's priceless. Like being able to like set yourself up in this town is huge. And I would sell the show again if they were like, well, we want to change it and do this with it. I'd be like, you take it. I don't give a fuck. Just pay me. But it was mostly still that I hadn't dealt with losing my best friend. And with my success, I felt like I didn't deserve it. So it also was dating a girl that was depressed, and you know, she was a fun hang, and we would just hang here at my place and order food, and I had the dog, and that was it. And I wasn't doing stand-up. Like, I wasn't looking for shows. If people offered me shows, I would do it. If the improv was like, hey, we got a spot for you Friday night, I would take it. And I had like my regular show with Avery and Jeremiah every week at the improv, but I wasn't going out. And skip ahead, the show gets canceled in July, comes out in March, gets canceled in July. And then in September, me and that girl are starting to get to a place where it's like, I could tell that she's holding me back, and we break up, and I start doing stand-up again, and I fall back in love with her. And then in January of 2018, I start dating this rock star chick, this very famous musician.
Oh.
And I open up to her about everything, about how depressed I am and the way people look at me and my resentments for the Comedy Store and everything. And she's like, and she says something to me, super profound. She's like, you have a light that burns so bright, and yet you have it on dim.
Oh, yeah.
She's right.
Can you say that one more time? It gave me the chills, and I just want everyone to, like, take that in again.
She said, you have a light that burns so bright, yet you have it on dim.
That's so powerful.
Well, it makes complete sense, because you can eat, you choose to get angry. You choose to feel like hopeless. Like, if you choose to feel hope, then, you know, and be happy, then you can be, because we make that decision. Nobody, there are people in far worse positions than us that are ecstatic every morning. It could be the way they were brought up, could be their parents, could be the love they were given throughout life, whatever. But they can be broke and be super happy. It's all perspective. And I could never look at what I had. But then that girl says, I want you to meet this guy. And she's like, we have to go to Ojai, but you got to keep an open mind. And I was like, okay. And so we go up there.
What was the pitch of who this guy is?
Say it again.
What was the pitch of like who this guy is?
She didn't give me any explanation. He's just going to help you. She's like, okay. He's going to help you. That's all she said to me. She was like, this guy will help. He helps me. We drive up to Ojai, and we get to this dude's house, which is like a little cottage on this little property. And I go in to meet the guy, and the girl stays outside after she introduces us. And then she's like, I'll leave you to it. And then the guy's like, so what did she tell you about me? And I was like, nothing. She's like, well, I'm a clairvoyant, and I read energy, and I can clear energy. And he's like, I work with some of the biggest actors and musicians in the world. He's like, so what we're going to do is I'm going to read your energy first. Then we're going to meditate a series of times, and I'm going to clear this wreckage. Because as you know, when you're born, you just have like pure existence. And then as your parents yell at you and school and friends and whatever happens, you keep putting these filters and just picking up more and more baggage to a point where you're carrying so much baggage that in front of your face that you can't see anymore. And that's where I was at. Wow. So he reads my energy in this fucking super weird way. I remember he goes, so I'm going to read your energy. And then he goes,
no, no, no.
That's what he did. And I was just like, all right, what the fuck is
it? How long did he do that little movement?
Minute, 45 seconds, maybe. I don't know.
That's bizarre.
Well, it was bizarre, but then it gets more bizarre. So he's like, your energy right now, you're at about 6%, which means 94% of your consciousness is tied up in baggage. So let's peel those layers of the onion away. So we meditate one time. First time we meditate, he's like, pull a picture up. Go ahead.
Was it a guy? Okay, you're going to tell me what he did.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you, hold on. So he's like, I close my eyes, sitting on the couch. He's like, all right, pull up a picture. and I pull up this picture, and it's of me and my dog, but it's like me and my dog are like far away, and it's like super like gradulated or whatever that word is, like it's grainy.
Yeah.
So it's just it's like super out of focus. And I don't know how long the meditation goes for, but then he ends the meditation and he goes, okay, well, I just cleared this amount away. He goes, let's meditate again. We meditate again. And he goes, pull the same picture back up. And I pull the picture up, but now it's not from far away. It's me and the dog, but we're super close and like crystal clear. And then the meditation goes for however long, and then it ends. And then he's like, all right, we're going to meditate one more time. And then he starts a meditation and like, dude, I am on another planet. Like I'm completely out of my body. I feel like I was on like DMT, like lights and geometric, you know, and algebraic signs and equations, whatever the fuck that you see when you're on DMT. And it was just a complete and utter out of body experience. And then when we're done, I start crying. And he's like, and he's just like, so you're clear right now. Like I've gotten rid of everything. He goes, I'm going to let you know right now. It's going to come back. But there's ways to work through that through reading, through meditation,
regularly.
And I rode this high for like 2 or 3 weeks. And I wasn't meditating. I was just completely like vibing off what the dude had did to me. And I started doing shows, and every show I was crushing, and I was just focused and present, not in my head. And then I go to the Comedy Store one night, and I'm about to go up. It's potluck. And the host is like, you're next, Josh. I'm like, cool. Not nervous at all. And then somebody walked in the room and I got nervous.
Like,
yeah, like it was the booker walks in the room and I got nervous.
The only person who ruins potluck.
but that's funny because he ruins it for everybody because we put the pressure on that. He wants us to do good. Do you know what I mean?
It's like, that's what I don't miss.
What, being judged by people of authority?
I haven't thought about that presence in the back of the room in 2 months. And it's just, it makes
me think
about it because it's interesting. Side note, you know, we're in here, we're making ourselves happy, we're growing, we're working on ourselves, you know, hopefully that's what you're doing during quarantine. If not, great, no problem. But like, it's funny to have that reminder, and it almost seems silly when we're in this to think about the stuff that we put on like the outside.
Yeah. Now in this kind of situation, you realize just what you actually need to be happy and, you know, because if you can be happy right now, then when the world opens back up, you should fucking just be ecstatic. Like everybody should be grateful at every set that we get to do from this point on moving forward, because it's not guaranteed anymore. Mm. You know what I mean? So, but he walks in and I go on stage. I don't do bad because I'm good. I've been doing it long enough and I'm good enough to get out of a bad set, but it was weak. Yeah. And I remember I went home that night and I was like, fuck, man. Like, why do I get nervous because of certain things in the room? I'm confident. I know I'm funny, blah, 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 blah. And then I just saw this book that somebody had given me when I was in the hospital 6 years earlier. And it was just like, it was almost like the book. It wasn't out in the middle of everything, but it was like, it was where I have my books, but it was just like glowing almost.
What was it?
It was called The Tao of Poo.
Oh yeah, you told me about that.
The Tao, T-A-O of Poo. And T-A-O. So it's T-A-O, but it's pronounced Tao. Yeah, it's Taoism. Yeah. So there's a book out there called The Tao Te Ching, which is written by a guy named Lao Tzu, and he was this incredible thinker. Yeah. But they wrote it. There's this other guy, this white American guy, wrote it and put it into a very easily digestible form of like telling the Taoist principles through stories featuring Tigger and Piglet and all the other characters from Winnie the Pooh. And Lucas Dick gave it to me when I was in the hospital. And I remember he goes, this book helped me when I needed answers, and hopefully this will work for you. But I never read it. I just threw it. But now, 6 years later, I needed it. I was ready for it. And the book stood out and I read it within like 3 hours. And then I was just like off to the races. Other people had given me some self-help books like The Alchemist and Power of Now and Autobiography of a Yogi. And I just read every self-help book, one after the other. And they're all basically saying the same thing, but I just took that principle, which is that you are not your thoughts. Your thoughts are like, I don't know how to explain it. Like there's, especially if you break it down into Vedanta, which is everything is not you. Even your thoughts are not you. Like my fingers are not you. Like it's like if when you feel a thought, you can see it and know and like, all right, this isn't me. This isn't what the way that I'm trained or this is not what I want. I don't want to think like that. I don't want to think that Chelsea hates me. Why would I think that? But you can either grab onto that or you could just see the thought and then let it pass. And so that's what I started getting from the book, Power of Now and the Untethered Soul. And then I called up the rock star chick who I wasn't dating anymore. And I was like, do you have like somebody that can teach me meditation, transcendental meditation? And she's like, yeah. And so she sent me to this guru. And then I started going to the guru and I've been going to him once a week for the last 2 years.
Is he different from the clairvoyant guy?
Yeah.
So why?
Totally different guy. This guy, the clairvoyant guy lives in Ohio. No, I've done like when they got, when I can't think of his name for some reason. Starts with an A, not Adam, whatever his name is. When that dude comes to that girl's house, the rock star chick, cause he comes to see her when she needs him. Mm-hmm. And she'll text me and go, do you want to do a session with him? I think his name's Al. And I'm like, yeah, dude. So I've done over the last 2 years, I've probably done like 4 or 5 sessions with him. And I always have like a real experience. I always cry when it's over. Cause even if it's not, if he's not even doing anything, I just believe it. And it feels, we meditate so long that I get in such a deep trance that I just go to a different planet. But it's just been because of the guru and the meditation and all the reading and then the acting classes, which I got you into with our coach Myra, it all these little things were just ways for me to get out of my head. And, you know, I still go there sometimes, but I get out very, very quickly. And now I can honestly say, like, I love myself. Like my past is not my present. And the future hasn't happened yet. So why worry about any of that? And two, that I'm a good, caring person that is not selfish, loves his friends, is willing to, is selfless in many, many ways. I still have an ego, but I'm able to not let it control me. And once I started thinking like that, Chelsea, everything in my life started happening. And so
talk to me more about that. And is this something that you learned from like the guru?
Well, I basically, everything I've learned in a sense is what I just summed up kind of in that last statement, which is just like you have to, when you have a thought that's negative, you just need to pull that weed out and get rid of it. Like it's just a matter of being able to see a thought come in and just let it pass. It's the same way when you meditate. Remember when I first started meditating, like thoughts would just run and run and run and run in the meditation. Now, like they pass, but yeah. But it's just, I literally go blank. I have like semi out of body experiences, you know, at least one portion of my meditation a day.
So are you doing TM twice a day?
I do it. I do it in the morning and I do it at night. But It was really the meditation with the acting class, because that taught me how to listen to what you're saying, react to it, and be present, because I could never be present. Like if I was around any comedian or actor or somebody that was famous, or I wanted them to think I'm cool, I would care more about them liking me instead of me liking them.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And that's the key to get people to like you. Just like them. Just be like, yeah, I don't give a shit if you like me or not. I think you're cool. You know what I mean? And that's it. And once you can get rid of the, you know, the I, it's like, well, it's like, I want them to think I'm cool. Like, you are cool. You just got to know that. And it was almost just like one day, a place like the Comedy Store that I used to hold so many resentments and feel so uncomfortable became this place full of love. Hmm. And I see it every time I go there now. And I, even around the bigger comics.
So is that changing your perception instead of focusing and looking at like all this negative, why am I not this? Why am I not that? Like, you know, all that kind of like negative energy and thinking that people can get into at the Comedy Store. Instead, you're choosing to focus on like a different view, a different perception.
Well, yes. Mostly it's just that I know that I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm a really good person, man. I really, really, you know, I made bad decisions when I was younger, and I used to wear those bad decisions like, you know, like a shawl everywhere I went. And I just, you know, thought that made me who I am. But I can look at all that, those mistakes, and be like, that's just me learning. Mm-hmm. Figuring this out. I had to learn the hard way.
Yeah, that's what I'm working on right now in therapy. It's like, because I look at myself like before, really like myself from 20 to 30 or even like 15 to 30, like I have a heart, like those feel like separate selves. And then like me now, or like in the past like 4 years of sobriety, like I feel like such a different person now. And like I have a lot of like shame and like judgment about that past self. And like, I'm really trying to learn to like give a lot of compassion and be like, okay, I didn't have the instructions. Like I was doing the best that I could.
Yeah. You're figuring it out.
Yeah.
Dude, it doesn't make a difference what you did in the past. It's what you do now. You can change at any moment. And I don't think people know that. They feel that whatever their past is what makes them who they are. But that doesn't mean anything. Dude, I did fucked up shit when I was younger. Mostly all to myself that just hurt me. Nothing hurt other people.
No, exactly.
You know, but still, it was like, it's embarrassing. You know, another thing that really helped me to get through all of that, which was going on podcasts. And so all those fucked up stories I have of things that I've done, I've told on so many popular podcasts, and fans love those stories.
Yeah.
So they've taken these things that are negatives to me for years, and now they've given me notoriety and fame, and people love it. And now that negative has become a positive. It's all about just shifting the perspective on it and using your... You know, it would be like, it's like, you know, I'll give you an example. It's like Samuel J. Comroe having Tourette's and being a comic and making fun of the Tourette's. He's taken this thing that he probably hated his whole life, and now it's this thing that he's so happy that he has. Mm. Because he's made a career. It got his career started, you know, and people laugh with him. And he's able to make fun of it. And when you're able to make fun of yourself and not take yourself too seriously and take life too seriously and take the booker at the Comedy Store too seriously, or if that agent likes you or doesn't like you, whatever the fuck, none of that means anything. The only thing that's important in life is literally just, am I enjoying this moment that I'm in right now? And right now I'm talking to my good friend. I'm in my apartment. My dog's over there, you know. I'm going to watch The Sopranos season 6 over the next week. Like, it's great. Life is great. I got food. I got snacks. I have everything I need to be happy.
That's what me and Steven keep saying every day. We're like, we have everything we need. We have, like, every day we've been like saying that. And like, we're just like feeling so much gratitude right now.
Yeah, you should. You guys, and you have each other, which is beautiful, because Steven's great and you're great. And that's like, you know, I would, the only thing that would make this better is if I had like a love during the quarantine, not just like a hookup, but I mean like a love, but I don't. But at the same time, I'm like, maybe that's just, I needed to work on myself. Maybe I needed time to really test all of the learnings and the teachings and all the readings that I've been doing over the last couple of years, I feel like have been culminating to this moment. Because if I never went through that breakthrough, Chels, I would probably be, I'm not going to say I would kill myself because I'm too afraid to do that, but I don't, I just, I'd be a mess. I'd be a mess. And
what if this,
go ahead.
No, no, no. Sorry.
I was going to say, if this goes until 2021, I'm fine. I could, you know, I'll figure it out.
Yeah.
I'll make it work. And
what
I'll be,
else did the guru teach you or kind of like,
well, no, it's like, so what we do is each week is we just, is we go, I go in and he tells me, ask me what my intention for the day is. And I give it to him. And then he's like, then I explain what I'm dealing with this week and what has been holding me back from growing or being happy. And then we talk about it. And he gives me a very philosophical approach to handling it, which literally could just be, you know, learning how to drop it or learning how to use it in my advantage. Or if it's just like with dealing with people, he'll put it in perspective. Well, that person's dealing with this and this and this too. And you go, oh yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. He's like a life coach guru, you know, like he's not like a Swami that's like got the
right. Rabble.
You know, he's some Irish guy lives in a mansion and fucking in the, you know, by Mulholland. Like,
what does he wear?
He wears Yeezys sometimes. I'll tell you that much. He's got like two pairs of Yeezys.
Cool guru.
He's very, very cool. He's Irish. I think he's gay. He kind of looks like the lead singer of The National. And he dresses like the lead singer of The National too. You know, he wears like G-Star, but not like hip hop. He's just like what an Irish guy would wear, like hip Irish clothing.
I love it. And is there any like memorable thing he told you, like all encompassing about how to like view things? Or is that too broad of a question?
I think that's too broad of a question. Like there's so many, the best thing I've ever heard ever in from either a guru or anything is something I learned in a 12-step program, which is your ego is not your amigo. I love that.
Yeah.
That's some 12-step shit right there that, you know, the guy that makes coffee, like has that tattooed across his chest right here, but yeah. But that's so true. When you realize that, you know, me getting mad that I'm not getting booked or I didn't book that or I'm not being invited to that, that's just my ego being hurt. Like, I give a shit. Mm. Dude, you don't have to invite me to anything. I'm happy by myself. Mm. I'm happy with in a relationship. I'm happy single. I'm happy when I'm booking. And I'm happy when I'm not booking. And it's just, you know, I guess it's being able to realize that, you know, all you really have, and this is real. Actually, also, I'll be able to give you something to put into perspective. You're going to die sooner than you think because life moves so quickly. So why don't you enjoy the short time that you have left on this earth? Mm. That's it. Because that was what I used to do. So when I started going through this process, Chels, and I was like getting ready to do a set, where I was getting ready to do acting or whatever the fuck it was, and I was nervous, I would remind myself that I'm going to die. And this is the fun part. Mm. This right here. Especially stand-up. I'd be like, why would I even remotely have a negative view about how this set is going to go when everything's fine? Like, who gives a fuck who's in the room? Who gives a fuck how the comic did before me? Who gives a fuck, you know, if this audience isn't my audience? If I go up there and set an intention to have fun, all right, I'll give you a perfect example. So when I taped that Bill Burr Presents, I was going to have my guru come with me because I was having a week of bad shows prior to the recording, doing the set because I was nervous, because I was just nervous and I wasn't acting right. Hey, Steven. Sniggy, sniggy.
Call and response, I'll be right back.
Go ahead, dude. Go ahead.
Here, give me all of them. Sorry.
Aw, little Jaggy Poo.
I love you.
I love you too, but you look good, man. You look really good.
My sister's diet.
Yeah, but you look tan. You look tan.
I've been tanning every day.
I mean, going outside or you're going to a booth?
Outside.
So yeah, just you look great.
Yeah, the essential booth of the coronavirus. Right? I mean,
there's a place that's open illegally right now. Love you too. What was I talking about? It was, So I was having bad sets because I was so nervous. I wasn't present. I cared so much. I cared more about, like, I wanted to crush. I wanted to do the best. And so I was going to have my guru come with me to the recording. And he goes, well, how about we just have a session day of, and then we'll make that decision that day. And then I met with him and we did this extra long meditation that day and he got me in the right space. And I remember he says to me, he goes, you're great. You're going to do incredible. Don't forget to set your intention. That was the last thing he said to me. And then I went to the place we were going to tape a few hours later. And I was like super comfortable and like riding a high from the session earlier. And I was like, this is great. I'm talking to Rosebud and all my friends that are there. And it's like, I'm dialed in, ready to kill. And then the show starts and people start going. And then I start getting a little bit nervous. And then they come up to me and they're like, all right, you're up. You're up in 10 minutes. And then it was like a whoosh of nerves. And I was like,
I feel it.
Oh, I was like, oh my God. I was like, okay. Yeah, dude, it was, I mean, I, anytime I get nervous, I have to shit. So I understand that. But in that exact moment where I started freaking out, I got a text from Johnny, the guru, and he wrote what he had said to me earlier. He goes, you're great. You're going to do incredible. Don't forget to set your attention. And I go, oh yeah. I just want to have fun. That's all I care about. I just want to have fun. And then immediately all my nerves became excitement. Mm. And then I went up and I ripped because I was like, if I don't care if they like me or not, like if I fuck up a joke, I could start the joke over.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't make a difference. Like it's a taping. Yeah. Like they'll make me look good. Even if I bomb, they'd make me look good. But I went up and I had such a great time. And when you do that, when you set intentions behind your actions and your thoughts, like you realize it's far easier to stay positive than it is to stay negative.
And when you're setting your intention, are you just saying it like over and over again? Are you like really trying to sit in that? Like what's like the act behind it?
Well, I first thing, you know, just like, you know, I know like you wake up in the morning, probably the first thing you do is like make your bed and maybe say a prayer. First thing I do is close my eyes and set the intention for the day. And it could just literally be me saying, today is going to be the best day of my life. And then I just get up and I walk out and then I'll write it. Like my notepad's over there, but I write it. Today's the best day ever. And I'll do those things like the gratitude list and shit like that. And then I'll think about it in meditation, but it's a lot of times it could just be spur of the moment, which is like, all right, I'm about to do a podcast with Chelsea. All right. I just want to have fun. That's all I care about. I don't have to be the funniest. If we get serious, great. As long as I have fun doing it, I don't give a shit what we do. And that really helps me. And, you know, I think it's just, it's trial and error. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but I know that, you know, as long as I try, I'm working towards the light instead of the darkness, and that's all that matters.
Yeah. Do you have any books or like resources that you would recommend in like the self-help world that kind of just like
help
you?
I just say you could do the main ones. If you want a very light read, get the Tao of Poo. So the two books that really helped me the most were The Untethered Soul by whoever, I don't know the guy's name. And which I've read so many times. And then Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. They're literally the same book, but Eckhart Tolle is just a modern day philosopher. And he's just, if you understand what he's trying to tell you about being present and knowing that the present moment is all you have, it's really, that's it, man. It's like this thing right here is all we have. And when you just take it down and you look down at your feet and you know that you're like, oh, right now I'm safe. And then it's just can bring you out of it. You know, it's incredible. Like some people love the Four Agreements, but the two that have helped me are The Untethered Soul and Power Now. They're great books, easy reads, like super easy. If you want them, I'll bring them over to you when I can start seeing people again.
Yeah, I do. Well, Josh, I think we did it, right?
We did do it.
Thank you so much for coming on, and let us know where to find your podcast and where to follow you on social media.
At Josh Adam Myers on all social media, last name spelled M-E-Y-E-R-S, and check out my podcast, The 500, with Josh Adam Myers on Spotify, as I go through Rolling Stone magazine's list of the 500 greatest albums with huge actors, comics, and musicians and famous people. It's great.
Awesome. Thank you so much again, and talk to you soon.
I love you.
Love you.
Thanks, baby.